Before we start today, I just want to make a small apology. Thank God things have been very hectic preparing for next week, Tuesday night. So I have to confess that for today's share, I've stolen a bit from some of the parts are from previous years. So I hope you won't mind a bit of review, revision. Sorry?
Don't worry, I'm not going to be
revision. You sure? Okay, I feel better now. So I normally try to avoid that as much as I can, not always possible, but anyway. Okay, so Parshas Re'eh is a packed Parsha. It starts off, we'll just read a couple of the first psukim, although it's not the focus of what I want to focus on. But it starts with page 998, where Moshe Rabbeinu is in the middle of preparing the Jewish people for their future journey into the land of Eretz Yisrael, for real life and so on. And he says, Re'eh, he says, see, have a look. Nosati anochi noisen lifneichem hayoim. I am placing before you today bracha, blessing, uklala, and the opposite of blessing, the curses. Es habracha, the blessing, asher tishmul mitzvayis Hashem alakeichem, asher neichem mitzav eschem hayoim. The blessing, of course, will come as a result of you listening to Hashem and the mitzvahs of Hashem, the commandments of God, which I command you, and the opposite for the opposite. And essentially, this is the concept of free choice, the concept of a theme that comes up a number of times, particularly in the book of Devarim, where we learn that there's a choice. I guess also the choice becomes more accentuated after they go into the land of Eretz Yisrael, because during the time they were in the Midbar, in the desert, they lived a very spiritual life, even though they made mistakes then too, and there were choices then too, but the spiritual choice is much more the obvious one. When the normal type of routine living begins, it's much more of a choice, which is why the Torah continues to explain that when they go into Eretz Yisrael, there was this ceremony they had to hold on the two mountains, Har Gerizim and Har Eval, where six tribes went on the one mountain, six tribes on the other, and as it talks about later in a couple of parshas from now, talks about turning to the one side and giving the curses, turning to the one side giving the blessings. So it was very clear to the Jewish people that the choice was theirs, and they had to choose life or the opposite of life. So that's just the introduction of this parasha. But one of the things that comes up in this parasha, we know that Devarim, the book of Devarim, is on the one hand this preparation, inspirational speech, so to speak, from Moshe Rabbeinu, inspiring and preparing the Jewish people to go into the land of Israel. But also we know that Dvarim is Mishneh Torah. It's the repetition of the Torah. So many mitzvahs, which we find already given in the Torah, were again given and repeated and reviewed during that long 37-day preparation speech that Moshe Rabbeinu gave. Many of the mitzvahs come up again. One of the area of mitzvahs, there's many mitzvahs in this week's parasha, which are given for the which we learn about for the first time and also were repeated, is that there are many in this parasha, but one of the categories of mitzvahs which comes up in this parasha a lot is kashrus, all laws of kosher. And when I say all laws of kosher, because when we talk about kosher, we talk about all the laws of kosher, which includes many different things. Although they are in the Torah, they're actually separate mitzvahs. They're not all the same mitzvah. Okay. In fact, it's an interesting thing. We've borrowed the term kosher for a very generic and general thing, right? In the Torah, the word kosher actually, you know what the word kosher actually means? Does anyone know? Sorry? It's lahakshir, to prepare something, to make something fit, all right? So, for example, we talk about kosher and non-kosher animals, in the Torah there's no such things. In the Torah, it's pure animals and impure animals, right? Kosher actually has to do with kosher meat. It's when you take meat, which you also learn this week's parasha, and you kasher it. In other words, when we shecht an animal, it is not fit yet to eat. It needs to be prepared in a special way. And that's actually where the term kosher actually comes from. I just thought I mentioned it because it's an interesting thing. Right? Lachshir, to prepare the meat for eating. When you shecht an animal, it's not yet prepared to eat. Now it is, after you do whatever you have to do with it, right? So, meat and milk has nothing to do with the word kosher, although we use talk about, obviously, if someone keeps kosher, they mean they keep meat and milk separate as well. If someone keeps kosher today, they mean that they don't eat non-kosher meat, right? So we use the term, but actually in the world of kashrus, the word kosher really only refers to the preparing of kosher products and making it fit to eat, which is interesting. Okay. So what are the mitzvahs which are covered in terms of kashrus in this week's parasha? Not all of them, but most of them are. The one is not eating blood. Okay, that's the one mitzvah. If I can find it quickly, I'll show you the pasuk. It's not easy, because I want to focus on a different part, but... one second. I don't have it offhand here, but it is in this week's parasha. It says, Rach Chazak. Ah, here we are, here we are. Yep, have a look at page 1004. So it says in the parasha, it talks about, it's a different, a specific context, it talks about eating animals that aren't specifically domesticated animals, like, for example, you know, in the Torah we've got, even among the kosher animals, we've got behemot, which is animals like oxen, cows, calf, sheep, lamb, and so on. Then we've got chayot, which are wild animals, like deer, buck, and things like that. There are 7 kosher wild animals, not commonly eaten today, although apparently in America you can get kosher deer, what do they call it, venison or something. Yeah, it's supposed to be very good, or apparently, never tasted, I don't know. And then you've got the kosher birds, right? So, over here, particularly the Torah is talking about the wild animals, like the tzvi, the deer, the ayol, and the buck, and so on. So it says, rakhaz, you can, these things are not fit for sacrifices. They were not, the cows and the lambs that we eat, that's also, from them they brought sacrifices during the temple times, right? But wild animals are not for sacrifices, but they're kosher, these particular ones. Then it says, rakhazak, but be very strong, levilti achol hadom. Sorry, it's page 1004, Pasuk Chav Gimel 23. Right? Be very strong not to eat the blood. Ki hadam hu hanefesh, because the blood is the soul. The soul of the animal is in the blood. And therefore, you cannot eat, so to speak, the soul of the animal together with the animal. So we have this prohibition not to eat the blood of an animal. We don't eat blood of any animal, not of birds, not of wild animals, and not of domesticated animals, right? Even the kosher ones. So what do we do about it? We have this process called kashering, where we salt the meat, salt it with heavy salt, in order to extract the blood. When you salt meat and you leave it there for its, a particular amount of time, you actually extract the blood. Most people today don't know what that actually looks like, because it's done in butchers and in farms. Not so long ago, the standard practice was for people to do it at home. Sorry? I'm sure, of course. I know how to kasher a chicken not by looking in the Shulchan Aruch. Although I've learned it in Shulchan Aruch, but I wouldn't have a clue what to do. I know how to do it because I watched my mother do it many times. So just to give you a little bit of insight in the process, so there's actually 2 prohibitions of blood in the Torah. I hope this is not too... I hope you can handle this, right? I'm not giving a live demonstration, you don't have to worry. There's 2 kinds of blood which is actually prohibited in the Torah. One is more rabbinic, one is more biblical. So one is called dam hanefesh, which is the blood which circulates in the body, which actually comes out when the animal is slaughtered. The other one is the blood which is absorbed in the flesh of the animal. So dam hanefesh, which we call the blood of the soul, that's really prohibited from the Torah. That has to be taken out. In animals, you have this thing where they've got a traber, they've got to take out the veins or cut the veins of the animals to make sure there's no blood left. There's a whole section of Shulchan Aruch, if someone eats heart meat, what to do with the blood that's left there, and so on and so forth. Right? But then the blood that's absorbed in the flesh, that can actually come out 2 ways, either by salting or by roasting, over an open fire, that is. Right? In fact, in Shulchan Aruch, roasting meat, barbecuing meat over an open fire is actually a better method. We don't use it mainly, but right? So when you put meat over an open fire, you actually don't have to salt it first, right? You can just put it over an open fire and that takes out all the blood and that's fine. In fact, that's how we kasher livers, because liver has a lot of blood in it and therefore we don't rely on the salting. And livers have to be kashered specifically by putting it over an open fire. Until very recently, they used to sell uncashered liver in the butcher. Not very, I'm going to say relatively recently. And not everyone knew, and it was a problem. I remember when a few years after I was here, a frantic person called me up once with a shiloh, that they went to the butcher and they bought meat and they assumed it was kosher, but they're frying the liver and it doesn't look right. Something is wrong. The color, in other words. I said, you bought roasted, like chopped liver or fresh liver? She said, fresh liver. And they didn't know. It was a whole problem. And they had to kosher their pans. If you could kosher a pan, it's a whole story. So, but they don't do that anymore. You can only really buy, I think, chopped liver now or kosher liver at least. Right? Because kosher liver is always roasted liver. So that's how you kosher animal. There's a whole process how you kosher chicken, how you kosher meat, the Kreibering process, of course. When they shecht an animal today, just so you know, it was part of the general laws of kosherness. The general practice all over the world is they only give you the front part of the animal. Why? Because the hind quarter of the animal is actually very problematic. There's a lot of other treif things there. For example, there's certain fats of an animal which you're not permitted to eat, which are mainly found in the back part of the animal. There's the gid hanasha, the sciatic nerve, which we learn all the way in the beginning of Bereshis, that is prohibited to eat, which is also found there, and it's very complicated to take out, and all this kind of stuff, and that's for, they just generally just sell it off to the non-kosher market, and they don't worry about it. So it's just easier. But there is a trebering process which goes on as well to be able to prepare it properly for us to eat. So that's the kashering process, and that's the one prohibition this week's parasha, the prohibition against eating blood.
So,
sure. Right. Dam ha'ivarim, other one's called. Sorry. Yeah. The blood absorbed in the flesh. Okay. The second area of kashrus we find in this week's parasha. Is meat and milk. Right? If you have a look on page 1012, 1012, towards the bottom. Second line from the bottom, the verse ends there, the verse 21, Pasuk of Aleph ends. Lo sevashil gidi b'chalev imoy. Do not cook a kid in its mother's milk. Right? This is the source in the Torah for not mixing meat and milk. Now this exact phrase, as we know, is repeated three times in the Torah. Twice in the book of Shmos, Parshas Mishpatim and Parshas Kisisa, and once over here. Okay? About not cooking meat and milk, and the way it's put in the Torah is not to cook the goat in its mother's milk. It doesn't only apply to goat, it applies, that's why I have the oral Torah, of course, to explain these things. It doesn't only apply to goat, it applies to all animals, it doesn't apply to the mother's milk, it's all milk and so on. And there's reasons why the Torah specifically put it as gedi, as the goat, or its mother's milk. There's all reasons, all kinds of halachas that we learned out from that. Essentially, however, why is it mentioned three times in the Torah? Because there are three prohibitions with regard to meat and milk. Now, first I should tell you this. Before I tell you this, let me just emphasize again that when we talk about some mitzvahs being biblical or some mitzvahs being rabbinic, it actually makes no difference in terms of observance. We have a biblical mandate to listen to rabbinic mitzvahs. I don't want to give the wrong impression that if something is rabbinic, it means it's not so bad if we do it, right? Now, there are certain leniencies with rabbinic mitzvahs which are embedded in the actual rules of the mitzvahs. But in terms of our attitude, mindset, in terms of how we observe them, mitzvahs are biblical, mitzvahs are rabbinic, are all the same. We have to keep them both, right? So I don't want you to think that there's some areas of meat and milk which are more lenient than others. They're not. However, having said that, the biblical prohibition of meat and milk is only if the meat and milk are cooked together, right? So biblically, one could have a cheese and salami sandwich because they're not cooked together. They're just lying on top of each other.
Cheeseburger,
but not if it's hot. If it's hot, then it would be considered cooked together. Then it would be biblical. But if it was just cold, it wouldn't, right? However, rabbinically, we're not permitted. But I'm only mentioning it because to explain, in the Torah, it doesn't say anywhere you can't eat meat and milk. It says you can't cook meat and milk. Lo tevashel, you shouldn't cook meat and milk. Now, it does mean you can't eat it because it's mentioned in the Torah three times. And the three times are for a reason, which I'll explain in a minute. And the reason that it always uses the term tevashel, to cook, is because the biblical prohibition is only if they cook together. Okay? So why does it say it three times in the Torah? So the Gemara explains to us that the three times, because there are actually three prohibitions. When you have meat and milk cooked together, there are three prohibitions. One is we're not permitted to eat it. We can't eat meat and milk that has been cooked together. Secondly, we can't have any benefit from meat and milk which has been cooked together, which is different to other areas of non-kosher. For example, you're allowed to have benefit from a non-kosher animal. Meat and milk is stricter. Right? There's certain things in the Torah where you can't eat, but you can derive benefit. Sometimes you can't eat it and you can't even derive benefit. So I'll give you an example. If someone happened to give you a present, let's say, something which contains non-kosher meat, not meat and milk, just non-kosher meat, it's okay, you say, what should I do with this thing? It's okay to give it on to a present to someone else. Or it's okay to sell it to someone else, let's say. Right? But if someone gave you a present of something that, someone left in your house, something that has meat and milk in it, that you can't have any benefit from it, which means you can't sell it and you can't even give it as a present to someone else. Because we are taught in the Gemara that when you give someone a present, that itself you're deriving benefit because you get goodwill from the person. Right? So you can't give it to a maid or something. You can't even do that. You have to actually throw it away. Right? I'll tell you an interesting practical application of this is that dog food or pet food doesn't have to be kosher. To pet food doesn't need a hechsher. Right? But it can't contain meat or milk. Not that it would, I'm just saying, but it can't contain meat and milk. Because meat and milk means you're getting benefit out of it, because you're feeding it to the animals. But any other kashrus issue is not an issue, but it can't actually contain meat and milk together, because meat and milk is something you can't even have benefit. That's the second time it says in the Torah. The reason that it says in the Torah a third time is because there's a third prohibition with meat and milk, that you can't cook it. In other words, a Jew wouldn't be able to work in a restaurant, for example, where they cook meat and milk. Even if he or she is not eating it at all or not, you can't actually bring meat and milk together and cook it together. I'll tell you an interesting, not that it's that practical or it would happen that often, but it could happen. If you were cooking, let's say, on two different stoves, meat and milk, right? And it was leftovers and they were both very hot. And you threw the cheese lasagna into the garbage. And then you realize in your fridge you've also got some leftover hot dogs that you want to throw into the garbage too. But by throwing them into the garbage, they will come into contact with the hot cheese. You shouldn't do that. You have to wait till it cools down.
Even though you're not going to eat it.
Okay. Correct. Because there's a in any other treif issue, doesn't exist. There's a prohibition to cook meat and milk. The definition of cooking is bringing two things or one of the things that are hot in contact. If one of them are hot, it's a problem. Right? I mean, not that it would happen often. I'm just saying it's something interesting to bear in mind. Because there's a prohibition not to cook meat and milk. Even if you're not eating it, doesn't matter. Right?
If it's cold, you can. If it's cold, not a problem.
It's not a problem, yeah. It's a problem to eat it together, because that's a rabbinic prohibition. So obviously we can't eat a cheese chicken sandwich or a cheese Islamic sandwich, obviously. And in fact, it goes even further. We know we have to wait. If we've eaten meat, we actually have to wait a time, whatever the custom is. Some people wait an hour, 3 hours, 6 hours, whatever the custom is, before you eat milk, because we have extra precautions and rabbinic precautions and things like that. But I'm talking about on a biblical level now. But to throw away meat and milk together is not a problem if they're both cold. It's just it would be a problem if they're hot. Okay. I just thought that's an interesting thing to mention. So that's also from this week's parasha, because it says lot of ashil gadi b'chaleivimo. You shouldn't cook milk in the mother's milk. That's the prohibition. It's the third time it says it in the Torah, and that's why it's three times for these three prohibitions: not to eat it, not to derive benefit from it, and not even to cook it, even if you're not going to eat it. Okay. So that's the second area of kashrus. Now the third area of kashrus, which is in this week's parasha, which of course comes before in Chumash in Parashat Shmini, but happens again in this week's parasha, is the kosher animals, fish, and birds. Let's have a look at in the Torah itself, and I want to go into a couple of interesting things there. Okay, have a look on page 1010, towards the bottom. Torah says that at the bottom, Pasuk Gimel, verse 3. Lo yisoichel kol te'eva. One should not eat anything that is abominable. Says the Torah, what does that mean? Zois ha-behema asher techeilu. First of all, with regard to animals, these are the animals you can eat. Shor seh, you can eat an ox, a sheep, ksovim, se'izim, goats, and so on. Then the Torah goes through the seven wild animals, which Even the art scroll doesn't know exactly how to translate all of them because they're not so simple. But it says, Ayol, which is a heart, Tzvi, which is a deer, of course, Yachmur, I don't know what it is, Va'akoi, Dishoin, Usoi, Vazomer. I'm not sure what they are, even the art scroll doesn't know what they are, so I'm not going to even try. But they're some sort of wild animal which are kosher. Now, how do we know? Now the Torah explains how we know which are the kosher and which aren't. Says the Torah, V'chol behemo, any animal, mafreses parsa, v'shoysas shesas shtei prois, which essentially means that it's completely separated into two hooves. It's got a split hoof, but completely split into two hooves that it's considered shoysas shesas. Ma'alas geira ba'behemo, and it's an animal that chews the cud. Oysa toichelu, those animal you may eat. Two signs of a kosher animal. Complete split hooves and chewing the cud. Achezeh lo soichlu, these ones you may not eat. Mima alei hageiro mafrisei apras, so even though they contain one of the signs. Ashesua. So it explains. Es hagomol, the camel. Vesar neves, the hare. Es hashofan, and the hyrax. I don't know what a hyrax is. Anyone know what a hyrax is? Huh? I don't know what it is. Anyway, these ones, they do chew their cud, but ufasa lo yifrisa, but they don't have split hooves. Therefore, tzmei v'hem lochem, they are impure for you. Right? Vesa chazir, and the pig, is the other way around. Ki mafris parsahu, it has split hooves, v'lo yigeira tomehu, but it does not chew the cud. In the Tehillim, there's a reference to Esav. It says Esav, you know, Yaakov's brother Esav, there's a reference to calling him a chazir, a pig. Why? So there's a Yiddish expression which has been developed from this concept called kosher chazir fisalach. What that means is, what is a pig? A pig is an animal that shows, it likes to stick out its hoof to show that it's kosher, because it has the externalities of being kosher, but inside it's not kosher at all. Esav was the same way. He came to his father and he says, "May himself a kind of tzaddik. He's kibud avaim. He respects his parents. He used to ask kinds of halachic questions of Yitzchak in order to trick him. How do you tie the salt? How do you tie the straw? You've gone through this before." And really, he was a no good nick, right? So therefore, that's a sign of someone who's really treif. It's even worse than, you know, we always think as the chazah is the most treif thing. Well, it's not actually, but that's always the symbol of the most treif animal. Why? Because it's got one of the kosher signs. But that's the problem. It's got the superficial kosher sign, but it's not kosher inside. So that's a really treif thing, right? So it says, Tomei hu lachem, it's really Tomei. Mi besaram lo yisechelu, you cannot eat their flesh. Mi nosam lo yisigo, you shouldn't touch their corpses, and so on and so forth. Okay. That's the kosher animals. Now let's go to the kosher fish. Es ze toichlu mikol asher bamoy. This you may eat, anything that's in the water. What is that? Kol asher lo yisnapir vekaskeses toichelu. Any fish that's got scales and fins, you can eat it. That's kosher. Okay. Now, if you skip a pasuk, we then go into the kosher birds. Okay. Now, I'm going through all three because I want to show you an interesting thing. The kosher birds, the Torah changes track a little bit. The animals, it gives us the signs of a kosher animal. The fish, it gives us signs of a kosher fish. When it comes to birds, the Torah does not give us signs of a kosher bird, although there are signs of a kosher bird, which the Gemara develops. But the Torah doesn't give it to us. The Torah just gives us a list of the non-kosher birds. All right, let's have a look. Kol tzipor tehora techeilu, you can eat any kosher bird, pure bird. V'zeh asher lo toichlu mehem, this is what you may not eat. Hanesher ve'aperes ve'aznia, it's all got the eagle, the peres, the aznia, and it starts to go through a whole bunch of words that are treif birds. In total, 24. There are 24 non-kosher birds. Essentially, what the Torah is saying, these are the 24 treif birds, anything else you can eat. Okay, but we'll see, it's very far from simple, but this is what the Torah is saying. Incidentally, I think I've mentioned this word before, but I want to just, it's a word I once heard from my grandfather about one of the non-kosher birds. It's called the chasida, which almost sounds like the righteous bird, right? The chasida, like chesed. So Rashi says, not here, but Rashi in Parashat Shmini says, why is the bird called a chasida? Because it does kindness with its friends. It's a kind bird, takes care of its friends. So the question is, if it's a kind bird, why is it a treifa bird? We'd imagine treifa birds are ones that have characteristics that aren't so nice. So the answer is exactly the Rashi's words. She'oisa chesed im chavrei seha. It's conditional kindness. She does kindness with her friends. People do kindness only with their friends. That's not kindness. That's selfish kindness. One should, of course, help their friends. They should support their friends. It's a good thing to do. But it's selective kindness. Selective kindness is not real kindness. That's why it's a trefa bird. Because it says, that's chesed im chavrei seha with its friends. That's not a kosher sign. Okay. So now, let's have a look at this bird. See, it's interesting. First of all, just going back to the animals and the fish for a moment. So the animals have to have two signs. Torah is very clear about that. If it has two signs, if it has only one of the signs, very clear, it's not a kosher animal. The fish, it says fins and scales. Interesting, we'll come back to this in a few moments. Interesting with a fish, you don't need to see both signs. You only need to see scales. The Gemara says very clearly, a fish cannot have fins if it doesn't have scales. Right? The Torah tells us both signs. Like if you saw fins but there was no scales. Sorry, other way around. It cannot have scales without fins. If a fish has scales, it definitely has fins. You don't have to see the fins even. Sorry?
So it's the scales.
Scales are the most important one, yeah. If you see fins, it doesn't mean that they're scales. Right? So if a fish, if you discovered a fish, it's got fins, but the skin has been taken off, you can't see the scales, or the scales shed itself in the water and it's hard to tell, you don't know what kind of fish it is. Not necessarily it's kosher, you have to be very, very careful. Right? However, if you see a fish with scales, you can be sure it's a kosher fish because it cannot have scales if it doesn't have fins. If it has scales, it for sure has skin, fins.
There's some fish that I believe when you catch the fish.
Oh. So the king clip in South Africa was a very big miser. I was just gonna mention that. Yeah. Now I'll tell you why. Because king clip was a fish in South Africa that was very common. And it's a good fish, yeah? What happened was as follows. It sheds some of its scales in the water. It does have scales when you catch it, but it's very small scales. There are different sizes of scales. And Al Pi Halacha is not quite always 100% certain what scales is good, what scales isn't. Now, with fish, and particularly with birds that I'm going to speak about in a minute, but even with fish, when we're not 100% sure about something, there's something we call Mesoira. Does it have a tradition of being kosher? The question is, how does the tradition established? Now, when the Lithuanian community came to South Africa, they had a very, very big rav. His name was Rabbi Kosofsky. There were a few Rabbi Kosofskys. He was called the Alta Kosofsky, whatever, the old Kosofsky, the original Kosofsky. Rabbi Yitzchak Kosofsky, I think his name was. Or Rabbi Michal, which I don't know which one was the father, which one was the son. But anyway, he was a very big rav. In fact, he was the brother-in-law of Rabbi Chaim Oizer. Rabbi Chaim Oizer was a very big Torah giant who lived in Vilna, who remained in Vilna. His brother-in-law was in South Africa. They did communicate. There's letters from Rabbi Chaim Oizer, who was an unbelievable halachic authority to Rabbi Kosofsky. I believe there are even responsive letters about the kingklip fish. Bottom line is, he said it was kosher. They established that in that time, going back a couple hundred years, they established that it was a kosher fish, and that was the derech. In the last sort of 20 years, somehow the whole thing came up again, and it was challenged, and did he really say that? And there was a very big tumult. I know the based in South Africa was quite upset about it because they didn't see a problem, but there was somebody in Israel started to challenge it. It was a whole had to do. At the end, they went to a Pesach in Eretz Yisrael. He said it was okay. Then someone else re-asked him, and he said it wasn't. It wasn't a clear thing. I think what the end they decided to do is they decided to say it is kosher. They re-ruled that it is kosher. But for those who want to be extra strict, what they call the Mahadrin restaurants didn't use it. But otherwise, it is a kosher fish. Bottom line, it was established that it was kosher, it had tradition. They relied on that tradition and they said it was kosher. Yeah, no. It's now kosher. Except in the Mahadrin restaurants, I think they don't use it. If I'm correct. Okay. Why am I mentioning this about tradition? Because this comes in out of the whole bird issue. Okay. So the Torah gives us 24 birds that are not kosher. Now, it should be simple. We should be able to identify 24 birds and everything else we should eat. So of course we can't do that. Even in the Gemara times they couldn't do that because the names change. The names change and the categories change, right? So even today, I mean, you can call a bird by a certain name and it can include other birds which maybe have a different name but they belong to that family. right? Which I'll talk about later, for example, like when the whole turkey question came up. Is it just part of the chicken family, or it's not a chicken, or it's a different kind of chicken, or it's a separate bird? So the names, we're not 100% sure that the biblical names are the same names we call it today. We're not 100% sure that the Torah's birds, when it listed, what it includes. Is it a family thing? Like when it says an owl, for example, are the other birds included in that owl category that also might not be kosher? So it's not 100% certain. So what the Gemara did was, the Gemara actually developed signs that you can tell if a bird is kosher or not. Okay. The first thing that we know about birds that are kosher or not kosher is that a bird is kosher is not a predator. It's not a bird of prey. Okay. That's one way you know about if a bird is kosher or not. Second of all, the Gemara said that kosher birds have certain signs. The Gemara talks about three signs. Now, I'm not a very big expert on animals, so I'm just going to share with you what it is. The Gemara calls it an extra toe, which I'll explain in a minute, a crop, and a gizzard that can be peeled, like the pupik in Yiddish, right? What does this mean? So the extra toe is like a toe that's sort of behind the other toes. Like if you look at a chicken feed or a duck, it has that, right? The crop is like an organ where it sort of stores undigested food. And the gizzard is like the stomach part that peels off very, very easily. Now, it's not 100% certain whether it needs all three of those signs or not, and so on and so forth. So even with the signs that the Gemara gives, it's still not 100% clear which birds are kosher, which birds aren't. Like, does it need all the four signs the Gemara says? One thing is clear. If it's a bird of prey, if we establish that a bird is a bird of prey, it's not kosher. If it's not a bird of prey, does it need all three of the other signs? Only some of them is good. Not 100% clear. It's not clear in the halachic authorities. So therefore, what developed with regard to kosher birds, you'll see where I'm going in a minute, because I want to share with you an interesting question that came up, where what came along the other things with birds is this concept of tradition. That today, we don't say that a bird is kosher just by relying on the signs that the Gemara says, but we actually go and we say, does this have a tradition of being kosher? Okay. The only question is, how do you establish tradition? Right? Now, there are other things that can be associated with kosher birds, which the Poskim mentioned. I'm just going to mention this because I'm coming up to this question. One of the things the Gemara says with regard to kosher animals, for example, is that kosher animals do not breed with non-kosher animals. However, it's not clear if that applies to birds also or not. So that maybe won't be sufficient. If you observe a bird and you see that it only mates with kosher birds, we still don't know if that's 100% good, because we're not sure if that concept applies to birds or not. So we have this idea of Mesoira. How do you establish the tradition? So the Gemara says, if you come to a town and there's an established Jewish community and they seem to have a tradition to eat a particular bird, and it happens to have the signs of kashrus also, in other words, obviously not a mistaken tradition, but they have a tradition that bird has always been used as kosher, you can rely on that. Not only that, but the halacha says if you go to a community where they have a tradition, but in your community you don't have a tradition, in that community you can eat it. Maybe when you come back to your community, you can't, because it's okay to rely on the tradition. Essentially, we have the signs. It's not one of the non-kosher birds. It's got the signs of kosher birds, plus a tradition. That is fine. Okay. Now, one of the signs of a kosher bird, or identifying a kosher bird, was written by one of the great poskim called the Avnei Nezer. The Avnei Nezer says, if you find a bird, which seems to be like some kosher birds, got the signs, but you don't know for sure. He says, one thing you could do is, if it's got eggs which are identical to kosher birds, then it's okay. Then you can rely, that's also good. Where did the problem start, as we know today? Where do we have this issue today? Although it's not really an issue anymore, but where was the issue discussed in the Poskim? With regard to turkey. Right? Now today, of course, you go to any kosher butcher, you can get turkey. But it wasn't so simple. Why wasn't it so simple? So turkey, we assume today it's indigenous to America. Okay. Columbus, which is why in America on Thanksgiving they eat turkey. Columbus discovered the turkey. In Yiddish and in some places it's called the Indian chicken. The reason it's called the Indian chicken is because Columbus thought he was in India. Right? So and he discovered this new thing, so he called it the Indian turkey. That's why it became known, right? What happened was, the turkey, when it was discovered, and trade started between America and Europe, they started to bring Turkey to Europe, even before there was an established Jewish community in America, or at least a proper established Jewish community in America. And that threw the whole Torah world into a whole thing about what is a turkey? What is this bird? Right? Now, you couldn't rely on the eggs being identical, because they're actually not identical. The turkey eggs are different to the chicken eggs. So one suggestion was that it was part of the chicken family. Therefore, just like chicken has a Messiah, we accept that chicken definitely has a tradition, right, of being a kosher. It was eaten by Eden for, I don't know, as long as anyone could remember. And therefore, if a turkey is just another chicken, a big chicken, so that should be okay. Others argued and said that turkey is not a chicken, it's a different bird. It looks like a chicken, it acts like a chicken a little bit, but it's a different bird, right? There was a suggestion among some of the poskim that in fact it wasn't just called an Indian chicken because Columbus thought it was in India, but in fact it did originate in India, and in fact some say they had proof that there was Jewish communities in India that ate the turkey for many generations. So therefore it wasn't a new thing on Turkey. By the way, there's a very interesting, as I was researching this, there's a very interesting response from Moshe Feinstein. Where he addresses this, but he addresses it in context of a whole other question. He asked if it's okay for Jews to get together on Thanksgiving in America to eat turkey. That was the question. So he dissects the question on many levels. Partly is like, what kind of holiday is it? Is it a religious holiday? Is it not a religious holiday? Is there a problem of going in the ways of the nations, which is also something mentioned in the Torah? Or maybe it's a good thing. It's just a power of thing. We're giving Thanksgiving to Hashem. It's not a problem. And there are American halachic authorities that deal with this question. It's a very fascinating question. Is it okay to get together to eat turkey on Thanksgiving? I think the bottom line, I think he was not 100% sure about Rabbi Soloveitcher said it's okay. And bottom line is there are a number of halachic authorities in America who say it's okay to get together and eat turkey on Thanksgiving because it's not religious, it's not connected with Avodah Zarah in any way, and so on and so forth. But in the tshuva, in that response, which was mainly to address whether you can eat turkey on Thanksgiving Day, he also addresses this concept of turkey in general, whether turkey is a kosher bird, right? So the Meshiv Davar, one of the halachic authorities, he says, no, it originates in India, there's a big Messiah, it's fine. Not everyone agreed with him, but the custom sort of developed that most poskim sort of seem to, or most communities seem to develop the attitude that it is a kosher bird, and that became the practice. Once that became the practice, many poskim write, that's enough of a Messiah, it's enough of a tradition to say that it is a kosher animal. Obviously, it's got all the kosher signs. And now that it's accepted, you can just say that's a tradition. So nowadays, bottom line is you can eat turkey. There were a few poskim who wanted to say not to eat turkey. One of the more famous ones was called the Shalom, Reb Shmuel Halevi Horowitz, who was a very, very great Kabbalist. I think he lived in Germany, if I'm not mistaken. He was a bit skeptic about the turkey. He said that he wasn't going to go against all his colleagues and the poskim, so he wasn't going to prohibit turkey, but he requested that in his family they shouldn't eat turkey. Okay, and there are still descendants of the Shalom today that don't eat turkey. I have cousins, not from the Gerari side because we're not from the Shalom, but I have cousins that from their mother's side, whatever the case is, they are from the Shalom and they don't eat turkey. On the other hand, I know many descendants of the Shalom whose name is Horowitz or Gorowitz, which is the same name, who are Levim, and they definitely come to Shalah, and they do eat turkey, because their family just didn't adopt that minhag, or whatever the case is. So it's interesting, there are some, out of this whole question coming out of this week's Parsha, and Parsha Shmini, there are some people today that still don't eat turkey. Which is interesting. But otherwise, for all intents and purposes, turkey is definitely considered a kosher bird. So today we eat duck, which has a Messiah, we eat chicken, which has a Messiah, we eat turkey. There are other birds which are for sure kosher, they're just not eaten. And they're kosher because we know that they're mentioned in the Torah as kosher birds. Like, one of the things we know is that when the Torah talks about sacrifices on the Mizbeach, there's nothing non-kosher that went on the altar. So, of course, doves and pigeons went on the altar, so we know for sure that dove and pigeons are definitely kosher animals. So, I don't know if people eat pigeons today, if they don't, but, huh? It's got to be shechted, yeah, but of course, yeah, all these things, of course, have to be shechted properly, except for fish. But, so those are for sure kosher. We don't need a Messiah, we don't need a tradition, they're just in the Torah, and it's clear what they are, and that's fine. Otherwise, the ones, the standard ones, are the ones that we eat. Okay. Let me end up by sharing with you a very beautiful idea, which I have used in the past, as I said in the beginning, but I'll share it with you again. It's worth a review, because it's a very beautiful idea. There is a Mishnah in the Mishnah that says the following. Part of it I just mentioned before, but it goes further than that. It says that kol sheyesh lo kaskeses yesh lo snapir. Any fish that has scales definitely has fins. Any fish that has fins doesn't definitely have scales. Okay. Then the Gemara says, any animal that has horns, a particular type of horns, yesh lo talfayim, you can be sure that animal has split hooves. However, just because an animal has split hooves, it doesn't mean that it has horns. Now that doesn't make the animal, unlike the fish, it doesn't mean it makes the animal non-kosher, because as long as it has split hooves and chew the cud, horns are not a sign. But nevertheless, just a fact, the Mishnah says that if it has split hooves, it doesn't mean necessarily that it has horns, but if it has protruding horns, you can be sure that animal has split hooves. What's the significance of this Mishnah? And what's the significance of this fact altogether? That a fish who has scale definitely has fins? So why do we need to know that? So then why don't we just focus on the scales? Forget about the fins. And certainly with regard to the animals, what relevance does it have to us knowing that if an animal has split hooves and has horns? So I'm going to share with you a diary entry. I call it a diary entry because after the Lubavitcher Rebbe passed away, and if I've ever shared this with you, they found two thick notebooks of notes that he had written for himself. Torah thoughts. Some of it was diaries of stuff that had happened. Some of it was things that he had prepared to speak about. Some of those things he spoke about later years when he became the Rebbe. This was done before he was the Rebbe even. Right, he had written two thick things and it was found in his office. Very hard to decipher, it had to be really worked on, and it was all published afterwards. Some of it was like stuff that was never spoken about. He had made notes, or maybe he had intended to speak about, but he had never spoken about it. So some of them were really new, innovative Torah thoughts, amazing stuff, which was sort of revealed only after he passed away. One of them is on this concept, on this Mishnah. And he asks what the significance is, and he gives the following insight. So I'm going to share it with you. He says, first of all, the Mishnah talks about fish and animals. What he says there is that the fish and the animals represent two types of Jews, two categories of Jews. The fish which are found in water, we know water is an representative of Torah. It's an environment of holiness. So the fish represent the people who their main occupation, their main focus, their main immersion in life is the Torah study, spirituality. They're more removed from the world, but that's their job. Everyone has their role. We have people in the world that their whole focus, their whole thing that they do is learning Torah, innovating in Torah, publishing Torah, ruling on Torah, and so on and so forth. That's one category of the Jewish experience. The other category is the animals that are found on dry land. Dry land is more detached from water, more detached from spirituality. It's more, the emphasis is more the physical world. So it's the people, obviously everyone has to learn Torah, everyone has to be engaged in Torah, but these are the people that their main job, like most of us, is to engage with the physical world. And each of them have their formula and each of them have their lesson that they need to understand. Okay. She says, this Mishnah is a lesson, it's a formula taught to each category of the Jew. Let's talk about the fish first. So what are the symbol of the scales? What's the symbol of the fins? So the symbol of the scales mean protection. It's a protection for the fish, right? What does that mean in terms of our service of God? So protection means it's not the thing itself, but it protects the thing, correct? What protects a Torah scholar? So here's an interesting thing. The Torah scholar, the Gemara says that learning Torah is an unbelievable thing, but learning Torah can be dangerous. It's an interesting thing, right? Not that we shouldn't engage in it, but it can be dangerous. Why? The Gemara says that Torah learning, he who merits the Torah will be a potion for life. He who doesn't merit, the Torah can become a poison. Why? Because knowledge can breed arrogance. If a person learns Torah without the proper preparation, the proper protection, the learning can breed to arrogance, and the Torah can be detrimental to the person. What is the protection? The protection is what he refers to as Yirat Shamayim, fear of heaven, subservience to God, always remembering whose Torah it is that we're learning, always making ourselves subservient to the ultimate intrinsic truth of Torah, understanding that there are axioms of truth in Torah which are non-negotiable, that the Torah is divine, it was given at Sinai, that the Torah is meant to be applied into practical observance, and so on and so forth. Right? When a person learns Torah with the humility that he or she is learning the Torah of God, and therefore is infinitely greater than we are, and in order to be open to Torah concepts, we have to have the humility to subjugate ourselves to some of the axiomatic truths that the Torah has within it, that Torah will be successful. So that's the scales. What do the fins represent? The fins represent the concept of chidush. Now, let me just explain that. One of the requirements of learning Torah, which is fascinating, particularly for people who are immersed in Torah learning, is the idea of Torah innovation, what we call l'chadesh, to innovate in Torah, right? Because there's a requirement to innovate in Torah is why we have thousands and thousands and thousands of books which were written by Torah scholar which have amazing new ideas in them. Okay? Now this in itself is an interesting, fascinating concept, this idea of chidush. And we used to have this in Yeshiva, the idea of looking at a piece of Gemara and analyzing it and sort of developing a new way to learn it, or a new angle to understand it, or whatever the case is. Of course, there were those great Torah scholars who are renowned for their amazing ability to come up with new ideas of how to analyze passages of the Talmud or passages of the Mishnah and so on and so forth. So being mechadet, now you can understand that this idea of innovating in Torah learning is a very, very important and an unbelievable requirement. But if you're talking about the danger of Torah to breed arrogance and to breed distorted thinking, there's no better dangerous ground than chidush. If you tell a person no chidush, just learn whatever it says, and just accept. Okay, then the danger is less. If you tell a person, no, don't just accept. Come up with a new way of understanding, come up with an analysis, come up with a fresh idea, so you can imagine what that could lead to if you don't do it properly. Says the Mishnah, for the Torah scholar, you got to know like this. So why is fins representative of the idea of chidush? Because fins is what gives the fish the ability to swim, right? And what fins do for a fish is it gives it the ability to take like a swish from one place to another. In other words, fins create the ability for the fish not just to move slowly, but to move from one place to another in one go. And that's why it represents the concept of chidush, where suddenly you come up with a new idea and you're in another place. Right? You're in a new level, a new place. That's why fins represent the concept of innovation and chidush. So he says, this is what the Mishnah is saying. If a fish has scales, if you approach the Torah with the proper subservience, the proper humility, you approach the Torah as a mitzvah, as God's Torah, as divine Torah, God will allow you and give you the ability to have fins. If you have scales, you will have fins. And that's a proper kosher fish. If you learn Torah with the right attitude, God will give you the ability to innovate. But if you have fins, just with fins, not necessarily it's kosher. You don't necessarily have scales. Scales is a sign you will have fins. Fins is not a sign you have scales. Because there are many people who have fins, who come up with all new ideas in Torah, a major chidushim, which have no basis, are wrong, are distorted, they're not based on the axioms of Torah, and they're just off the rail thinking. Why? Because the person who came up with them, they're very clever, but they don't have fear of heaven. They don't approach Torah the right way. That type of Torah learning is not a kosher fish. It's possible to be there, but it's not kosher, because it doesn't have scales. So if you have scales, Hashem will give you the fins, and you'll be able to do that. Proper scales, if you have fins. But if you have fins, not necessarily you have the scales. Okay. That's a lesson for the Torah learner. Now, what's the lesson for the person who's engaged in the world? Of course, being engaged in the world is also dangerous. It has its own dangers. Every path of serving Hashem has its own dangers. Being involved in the world is very dangerous. Being involved in the physical world has a danger of being lured into the temptations of physicality and materialism and losing the whole focus and purpose why we're there in the first place. Of course, the reason to be engaged in the world is to elevate the world and to bring godliness into the world. But we know that being engaged in the world can that's the kosher way of being engaged in the world. And that's why we're engaged in the world. God wants us to be engaged with the physical world, to bring God into the world. But of course, we know there's a very non-kosher way of being engaged in the world, is that you forget about God and just you go with the physical and material world. So how do you remain kosher? So generally, and I'm bringing in here something that Rebbe talks about somewhere else. The Torah says there are two signs. There are two signs of a kosher animal. One is chewing the cud, and one is split hooves. And in another place, the Rebbe explains what do the two signs mean. How do you become kosher? Again, animal on the ground. Animals is a symbol of materialism, meat, flesh, world, earth, detached from the water, and so on. First is you have to chew the cud. Chew the cud means review, reflection. That you have to keep on coming back. Is this right? Questioning, reviewing, not relying on what was good enough 5 years ago, but always chewing the cud, essentially. Always coming back and chewing it up and breaking it down to components and asking questions. Is this correct? Is this what God wants? Is it just my ego driving me to do this? Or is it really what God wants me to do? Now, of course, there are areas in life which are very clear-cut. Hashem gave us mitzvahs, so certain things are permitted, certain things are not permitted. Very much clearer. But there are many things in terms of our engagement with the physical world that are not clear, that we can easily talk ourselves into it, that are the right thing to do, but are not necessarily kosher. And that's, we need a lot of reflection for that. And that reflection and review is hinted in the concept of chewing the cud. What's the split hooves? Split hooves is something we've talked about many times. Split hooves means that in order to be kosher, you've got to have both personalities of chesed and gevurah. It's got to be split. You've got to be able to know that even if you're a chesed person, you might need gevurah, and even if you're a gevurah person, you might need chesed. Because to be a kosher person and to serve God in the physical world, the call of the hour will not always be the same. Sometimes it will be chesed, sometimes it will be gevurah. If you're always going to go with your personality, you're going to land up a treif animal. But if you're going to be ready to be able to say, that's my personality, but right now I need something that's different to my personality, that's the pathway of being kosher. So says the Mishnah, it's a journey. It's a journey. And the journey is not always, the journey has to be kosher, but the journey is not always to achieve perfection. And that's why the Mishnah says that he who has horns, an animal that has horns, meaning they've reached a certain level of righteousness and perfection, you can only get there if you have split hooves. You can only get there if you have a kosher pathway. But he who has hooves doesn't mean you have horns. And that's okay. As long as you have hooves. As long as you have hooves, which means as long as you are ready to engage in the chesed and gevurah. Or another concept of the hooves he explains over here is that the hooves separate you between you and the ground, which is symbolic of being separated between us and earthliness. Even when we engage in the world, we need to know that we stand higher. That the world and the worldliness doesn't become our identity. We always have to have that separation. We always have to have that kind of detachment from worldliness to revisit and re-engage in spirituality so that we know we're not part of the physicality of the world. If you have hooves, you're a kosher animal. You don't have to have horns because it doesn't mean you achieve the perfect state. But at least you're on the pathway to do what you need to do and to achieve the mission, which is the concept of the split hooves. And that's the message to the one who's not in water, the one who's engaged with the world. You've got to try hard. You've got to review. You've got to reflect. You have to chew the cud. You have to have hooves, which means you have to have chesed and gevurah, and also retain and maintain a certain detachment from the world. You don't have to have horns. You don't have to reach perfection, but you have to be on the journey. And that's the spiritual message that he learned from this Mishnah. So that's all just some interesting ideas from the kashrus aspect of this week's parasha.